The Mitchell's Front Page Podcast is brought to you by Geelong Bank. Listen live on 94.7 The Pulse, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11.
So I thought, why don't we talk to Terry Barnes, our political analyst, who we've spoken to many times over the journey on the program, and very, very interesting times indeed at all levels of politics. Terry, good morning. Thank you for being on the program.
Good morning, Mitchell. I'm happy to be second best.
Well, just first of all, I suppose we have to start with the Four Corners program. I don't normally watch Four Corners, but a friend of mine got in touch yesterday and said, tune into Senate Estimates, which I did, and there the senators were grilling the ABC's managing director about the program. It's unusual to see that sort of grilling before a program goes to air.
Well, that's right. And certainly after seeing the program last night, I can understand why there were some coalition MPs and senators concerned about it. But I think the issue with the program is that it focused entirely on the behaviour of Liberals in the Canberra bubble, as it was called, and not on the fact that that type of conduct, that type of behaviour is actually more than bipartisan. It's right across the parliament. Indeed, it's right across the press gallery. And to single out two, yes, senior MPs and ministers was obviously they considered it in the public interest, but others didn't. And that was the issue, I think, of the exchange at Senate Estimates yesterday. But my sense about the program itself was that because it focused entirely on the Liberal Party and entirely on the government, it was an unfair representation of the reality in Canberra.
Did they shoot themselves in the foot a bit by raising it at Senate Estimates? Because then that guaranteed that people like me would be watching last night.
I think you actually make a very good point. I think I wouldn't have made such a public song and dance about it. I would have braced for it and anticipated it, and I'm sure the two ministers who are at the centre of the story and the allegations would have been prepared for it. But I don't think their colleagues running interference for them in such a way help their cause. It actually, as you say, I think got more people, more politically aware people to actually watch the program, including myself.
There were some concerning allegations, and there's no doubt about that, but I did think there's some questions perhaps about what someone did 25 to 30 years ago. If you go through every politician and what they did 25 to 30 years ago, I'd imagine there'd be some pretty startling revelations. And I suppose the question up for debate this morning is, how much emphasis do we put on what someone did 25 to 30 years ago against who they are? I mean, I'm a different person today to who I was 25 years ago. I don't know about you.
My wife would say so, but probably not in a good way. But look, I think that's exactly right. And it did look like a very targeted and very deliberate hit job on Christian Porter in the way that it was put together. And using, as their chief witness, so to speak, a barrister who knew him back in university days. And when I get the distinct impression that he was a bit of a bad lad, no question. And some of his attitudes back then may not be his attitudes today. And certainly, look, I think it's... these types of exposés have their place, because I think we do need to focus sometimes on the reality versus the rhetoric when it comes to our political leaders, our MPs, our senators, our ministers. But to really pick over personal and private things in such a public way, I actually thought there was a bit of prurience, a bit of voyeurism in the way that it was presented, and I think it... While I noticed that the other minister involved, Alan Tudge, has expressed regret for the damage that was done to his family by the affair that was revealed on national television last night. Sadly, he's no longer married, and then knowing his family, knowing his wife, I think that's very sad. But it's not really helping the national conversation. It's not really doing anything other than saying, well, as the Four Corners premise was in the intro last night, that when politicians present themselves as being one thing, when they're actually doing another, there is a disconnect between morality and their position, which could be seen as hypocritical.
That seemed to be the problem.
I don't have a problem with, but the way it was done and the way it was focusing entirely on two members of the government as opposed to the culture right across the board in Canberra. And I noticed Christina Keneally, the senior Labor frontbencher, was hinting that it was more than just a Liberal Party issue, but quite happy to join in the partisan pylon. So I think that that partisan pylon aspect of it was disappointing. The conversation we need to have about standards in public life, and I think I don't always agree with Malcolm Turnbull, but his comment essentially that as a senior minister, as a leader of the community, you need to practice what you preach. I think there is something in that.
Yeah, I think that was the big revelation to come from the program last night about how you can't really be arguing for family values and putting yourself out there as someone who upholds family values, but then doing the exact opposite in your private life. There's got to be some congruency there.
Well, that's right. But I think the other side of it is, having worked in the Canberra bubble myself for quite a long time, that place is, it's got a level of amorality to it that the normal world doesn't. And Malcolm Turnbull's right. I mean, there are practices and there are behaviours on Capitol Hill in Canberra that would not be tolerated in any other workplace. But on the other hand, because of the nature of the business, you go in there at 7 o'clock in the morning, you may not get out of there until 10 o'clock in the evening. You do work hard, but you also do play hard, and particularly on the Wednesday night of a sitting week when Parliament does adjourn early for the evening and people go out and let their hair down, and sometimes that's done in a quite inappropriate manner.
And Malcolm Turnbull was criticised a bit at the time for the so-called bonking ban, unfortunate name, but I think where he was coming from at the time was probably spot on.
Well, I think that's right, and as far as the name goes, it was not unfortunate, but good alliteration, and people still remember it, don't they? But I think the notion that you don't have relations with the people who work for you is right. It creates power imbalances, but not just between the member and the staffer, but also I think when those things happen in an office, it actually creates imbalances between other members of staff as well. And it's basically unethical. It's wrong. I don't have and certainly I think it was right to highlight that aspect of it. And certainly Barnaby Joyce paid the price publicly for his stupidity and error of judgment in having an affair with his own press secretary. Mm. But the reality is that I think the Canberra culture itself needs to be questioned, not just the behaviour of one or two senior MPs. And as I say, the disappointing aspect of that program last night, besides the fact that it caused pain to the families of both those ministers, was the fact that it focused entirely on the Liberal Party and not on the behaviour of MPs generally, and I must say, having worked there, not on the behaviour of some members of the press gallery who, if you like, are known for sleeping with the enemy.
Just in terms of the whole cultural aspect, and yes, I think that is important, how do you go about changing that culture, or is it really too far gone? How do you make the culture of Canberra a more inclusive place, particularly around respect for women?
Well, look, I think, again, in my experience as a staffer at a senior level for 8 years all up, yes, there were some, there were some power imbalances of that sort of sexism, that sort of behaviour. But I think, on the whole, most MPs and senators do actually behave themselves and do actually conduct themselves in an appropriate manner. And certainly when it comes to, well, people doing naughty things, there's also this question of consensuality, isn't there, that people consent to be involved. And you can't always simply assume that it's a harassment or an abuse of power issue. But look, I think the reality is that while we expect our politicians to go up to Canberra, work their bums off for a week or a fortnight at a time, and be away from home, be away from normality, going into that amoral bubble causes temptations that, you and I in the real world and I'm sure listeners generally would not normally have. But I think that sense that MPs are entitled and special, though, simply because of their title and because of their job, does get to some of them. And it's not just in a matter of personal relationships. It's in a matter of their behaviour to other people.
How long do you think they will last, Alan Tudge and Christian Porter, or will they be able to dig in and ride out this storm?
Well, we're talking about past tense issues, sadly, for both ministers and their families. And both ministers are no longer married to their wives at the time of those indiscretions. So they've paid a personal price. In terms of the political price, I think they both will survive, partly because of the way that the report was presented as a really a partisan thing. But what I think you'll find, though, Mitchell, is because, as I say, these things happen across the political spectrum and across the media spectrum, that there'll be a bit of a kerfuffle for the next couple of days, but I think you'll find it dies down very quickly because there's the old saying about people in glass houses. I was going to say grass houses shouldn't throw thrones. No, glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And there are a lot of stones to be thrown in all directions. And one of the things I think that concerns me about all of this is that if tit for tat starts, then it's really going to be demeaning and not a very, very pleasant sight for our political class to be seen as, serial offenders against morality.
You said that it was a partisan program. They've justified that on the program Four Corners by saying, number one, the Liberal Party's in government, so they should be held to a higher standard, and number two, the Attorney General is the sort of first law officer of the land, and therefore they should be held to an even higher standard than some other cabinet ministers. Do those justifications wash with you?
No, they don't, because effectively talking about private behaviour, it doesn't affect their public behaviour, and it doesn't affect their public position and decision making. You can't actually make that accusation. But my point is still the same, that if you are going to make these revelations, you should focus on the fact that the behaviour in Parliament, as I say, it's more the exceptions rather than norm in terms of people's standards and morality, but nonetheless, it is non-partisan. It is across the board. It is also across the parliamentary press gallery. They have to actually accept and probe it in a way that doesn't look like it is a partisan witch hunt. And I think, unfortunately, I think the legitimate issues we've just been discussing got obscured by the fact that they're really doing a hit job on Christian Porter in particular, but also Alan Touch.
So on to some other things, and first of all, in terms of COVID-19, another great day for Victoria because we've had zero new cases and zero deaths today, but I also hear that there's now talk about a possible vaccine on the horizon, and it's hard for me as a layperson to interpret all this information that comes in about vaccines because I think you've just got to be a bit sceptical and wait until it goes through all of the processes. Have you heard anything that makes you feel very positive that there is something that's about to be on the horizon?
Well, I think the fact that it's been announced is a positive thing. I mean, Pfizer, as a drug company, wouldn't be racing out there to say that we think we've got it if they didn't think they had it, because I think the consequences, both in terms of their reputation and their financial bottom line, would have been catastrophic if they basically overclaimed and underdelivered. I think it's very encouraging, and certainly very encouraging if Australians get access to them. Vaccine sometime in the first half of next year, because that was probably the key to becoming COVID normal. And really, I think it's excellent news for all of us. And dare I say, it's even excellent news for Donald Trump, because this vaccine was developed, as Pfizer has confirmed, under his so-called Operation Warp Speed. So if he does, well, let's assume he does leave us on the 20th of January, and certainly that's the way it is. Somebody has to convince him of that.
Yes.
That will be a very important part of his legacy.
What do you think the take-up rate of a vaccine is going to be like in the community? Will people be trusting? Because I know that there is some arguments already that it's maybe been rushed through. Will people be willing to go out there and get it? Because we know that the consequences of not having a vaccine are very, very high, like lockdowns, etc.
Well, I think that's very, very much a very good point. And my sense is that they really have to make the case to show that this vaccine is effective, that the vaccine is safe. Certainly I wouldn't want to go and take something that was done in a rush and bypassed things such as randomised clinical trials, for instance. And as far as I am aware, that has not happened in this Pfizer case. But certainly I would want to have full confidence that the vaccine is safe as well as effective. But We've seen that when a vaccine is put up against a epidemic or a pandemic, as we did with the polio vaccines, the Sabin-Salk, Jonathan Salk vaccine in the 50s, it can be very effective very quickly and be a big step on the way to either suppression or the elimination of the disease it's actually treating. And let's just keep our fingers crossed that we may well have something here. And, of course, there are the vaccine trials and development going on, including one that's centred on Oxford University in the UK.
And they've announced with various vaccines that we're going to start manufacturing that in Melbourne, which is great news for our local economy. But on the flip side, can you decide what you're going to manufacture before it's gone through those randomised clinical trials?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And my sense is that they have to have the capacity to produce the vaccine. But as I said before, I mean, I would, as a consumer of it, want to be absolutely certain I'm not taking any undue risks. I think we've got the Sabin precedent on the one hand, but we've also got the thalidomide precedent on the other. And I certainly wouldn't want to risk unintended consequences or side effects of a vaccine that is so new that it hasn't fully been proven.
More broadly, what do you make of where we're at in Victoria? Because the government is saying our position now is the envy of the world. We've got fewer cases now than New South Wales and Queensland, which is quite an achievement in and of itself. But, of course, it's come at a tremendous cost.
Well, in the words of Mandy Rice Davies, they would say that, wouldn't they? It is very much, I think, padding themselves on the back of the government. But reality is, as you pointed out, I think we're up to day nine now of a double donut, and that's an outstanding result for Victoria and Victorians, not simply the Andrews government. And look, I personally believe that the second wave was avoidable. Certainly, on the evidence that's been coming out of the hotel quarantine inquiry, but the bottom line was it had to be dealt with, and certainly Victorians knuckled down to the task and actually were quite accepting of the need to do what needs to be done. And the fact that opinion polls have showed that in spite of everything, in spite of his government's culpability around hotel quarantine, Daniel Andrews and his government are still riding high in terms of popular support and electoral support, says volumes about Victorians' attitudes. I mean, it happened, we needed to clean it up. We seem to have got the job done, but we have to, I think, from here on in, get the balance right between common sense precautions and keeping the economy open and opening it up more, because, frankly, Victoria and Victorians can't go on with their economy, our economy, crippled in the way that it has been, but Australians generally can't afford to keep carrying us much longer in terms of support such as JobKeeper and JobSeeker on the scale that they are.
Do you think people will just get out there and start spending on the weekend, or will it take time for the economy to recover back to the point that it was?
Well, I think it will take time, and it will take years, and certainly in the service industries, particularly retail and hospitality, it's going to take a long time, and there will be businesses after JobKeeper particularly runs out that won't reappear. But on the other hand, I think in terms of the Victorian economy, and particularly the regional Victorian economy, things will get pumping pretty quickly. And I'm sure you're having a real influx of my fellow Melburnians down your way at the moment. And good luck to them. And good luck to particularly along the Surf Coast there. But my sense at the moment is that because of JobSeeker and particularly because of JobKeeper, the real economic damage is being concealed from Victorian public, and in a sense it's made Daniel Andrews' job a lot easier, because people aren't really feeling the economic pain in the same way as they would if that federal government support wasn't there.
Yes, and the US election situation, Donald Trump is refusing to concede from what I can see at this stage, but the world leaders like Scott Morrison have already come out and congratulated Joe Biden. He gave his victory speech, so they're very much moving on with business. I suppose.
Well,
the question...
it's been interesting to see how quickly that world leaders have been moving on with business, Mitchell. It's I quite respected Scott Morrison, his statement, for being generous to Donald Trump at the same time. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, I think you've got to show grace and dignity to the vanquished, as well as, if I could put it this way, sucking up to the victor. But other world leaders, including Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron in France, and certainly Angela Merkel from Germany, didn't waste any time being nice to Donald Trump. They just tried to, went into sucky mode for Joe Biden. And I don't think that actually helps the conversation. But I think Donald Trump's behaviour, though, makes it very hard for anybody to feel charitable to him. Particularly at this time, but depending on what sources you read, it appears that the White House is, or people in the White House of influence, such as even Melania Trump, are encouraging the president to accept reality, and I think while he's entitled to challenge outcomes and results and vote counting processes. It's not like Florida in 2000, where there was only one state where there was an issue. Now there are a number of states that are in his sights in terms of questioning the result. And I think when you're doing that, you're basically admitting that you don't have a leg to stand on.
Well, I think it's problematic that he hasn't really, or I haven't seen any really major substantive evidence that suggests that there has been electoral fraud. That kind of makes you look a bit desperate, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and certainly... the way that he came out the other day and made blanket allegations of fraud without any substantiation didn't reflect well on him. But I will say this, though. I think the fact that American media networks had the temerity to cut off the President of the United States because they didn't like what he was saying was very worrying. I think that type of censorship, they would call it self-censorship, I'm sure, but that type of censorship of... somebody who is still the leader of the free world and not giving him the chance to have his two bobs worth, but giving the public a chance to assess the value and validity of his two bobs worth,
yes.
I think was absolutely wrong.
And, I thought it was good that the ABC, although I saw on Media Watch last night because I stayed around to watch that, they were criticising the ABC for not cutting him off, but I thought that was the right call. And then, by all means, come in after the speech with your analysis and have the experts say what
precisely.
They think of what he said, but let's see what he's got.
If he was talking BS... they're quite entitled to call it out based on the substance of what he said, but to actually effectively gag him, I thought was unethical and even unprofessional. And certainly some of the comments that were made by some commentators, I think Anderson Cooper of CNN likened Donald Trump to an obese turtle,
yes.
upended and flailing in the sun. That type of imagery is not helpful either. I mean, I think the thing about... But it does remind me that 71 million people still voted for President Trump, notwithstanding the full onslaught from the political class, not just the Democrats, but pretty well right across the political board, dealing with the television networks, dealing with the New York Times, Washington Post. The fact that he managed to garner so much support, I think, is a question that the Democrats, and particularly President-elect Biden, need to ask themselves some very hard questions about. And if they don't, they may well find that their reign is one term anyway, because if they don't address the dissatisfaction, the unhappiness with, the economic or the social situation in the US, that 71 million people are prepared to re-elect Donald Trump, notwithstanding everything that's egregious and offensive about him, does mean that there is a serious fault line in American politics and American society. And, Joe Biden talked about uniting, being a uniter, but when some of his partisans like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the
yes.
famous AOC, and Nancy Pelosi and others talking about revenge and lists of Trump supporters who were she's got a little list and they surely won't be missed, as Gilbert and Sullivan would put it. That type of nastiness is clearly not just the Donald Trump thing. It may be that it's pushing back against him, a reaction to him, but... nonetheless, the tone of some of the triumphalism post Tuesday or post certainly Saturday is something that we in the wider world need to still worry about.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program. Thank you for your analysis, and we'll catch up again at some time soon.
Thanks so much for asking, Mitchell, even if I was the second choice.
But still very worthwhile. Thank you very much, Terry Barnes, joining us there, political analyst.
The Mitchell's Front Page podcast is brought to you by Geelong Bank. Listen live on 94.7 The Pulse, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 to 11. Or search for Mitchell's Front Page on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or wherever you get your podcasts.